Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Every week we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea behind it is to honor them for their service and for their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity, and hopefully along the way the rest of us will get a little inspired by the stories of the greatest generation. Maybe we'll think about doing some of the things that they did way back when. Not that I would suggest you try anything that Max Roof is going to tell us about today, an 86-year-old Marine veteran of World War II. You certainly don't want to be carried off of Iwo Jima in a body bag, and Max is going to tell us how that unfolded so many years ago. But before we get to his story today, I want to remind you about the Veterans Day Parade coming up November 11th in the city of Fresno. It'll start off just after 11 in downtown Fresno. And here is some extra significance for this year. The Marine Corps, by the way, is the honored branch of service this year. And if you come to the parade, you're encouraged to bring a toy for the Marine Corps' Toys for Tots campaign. But that parade, put on by Bill Dietzel every year, you've heard from him here on this program. You know how much he loves veterans around this valley and around the country. He has arranged for that parade to be televised on the Pentagon Channel this year. That reaches 2.6 million armed services personnel around the globe and 17 million homes around the world. So Fresno and its love for veterans will be in the global spotlight on November 11th this year. Hope I'll see you in downtown Fresno on Thursday, November 11th. Before then, November 6th at 10 a.m. at Fresno's VA Medical Center, there'll be a new dedication of the Wall of Honor. It honors the names of veterans from all branches of service, and that wall continues to grow. There'll be a special ceremony there November 6th at 10 a.m. And today's guest is actually someone that I have something in common with. We are both graduates of Las Banas High School, and this is a former Tiger track star here, Max Roof. You held the mile record for Las Banas?
For 20 years.
Now, what do you think you'd run the mile in now at age 86?
Quiet, please. And I wish I could say what, but it would not be anywhere close to the 4 mile plus.
Well, I'll let you slide on that one. I know I couldn't run a mile in a little over 4 minutes, so I'm not going to expect you to do that at age 86 either. To start your story, actually, before you ended up in Las Banas, you were born in 1924. You had a brother a year older than you, Dave. And you and Dave were living in an orphanage. I don't know how many people I've interviewed with a story like this, but I think it's important to touch on. I was driving down the street recently, and there's a billboard with Babe Ruth on it. It talks about how he started out in an orphanage. You never know where you're headed, but you started out in an orphanage. What do you remember about being adopted and taking on that last name that you have now?
Well, the thing that I remembered mostly is that it was quite pleasant at the home that we were at. Of course, we were like in 3 and 4 years old, and so but we were then adopted to the Fred Roof family, which is just great. They were our parents, and we loved them dearly. But it was okay. I can't complain.
Well, no, looking back, I guess there's not that much to complain about when you look at the big picture. You just handed me your business card with the 5 corporations that you founded and ran for a long time. You've got 6 kids and 16 grandkids and 2 great-grandkids. Don't want to leave them out. None of them would have ever been born if you didn't make it back from World War II, so we're going to talk about how that all developed. You graduate from Las Banas High School in 1943, but the war's already been going for a while. Maybe the first thing I'll ask you is December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day and how you heard that America was under attack?
I remember not a lot because I was, again, very busy in school. But the more I heard about it, and the more I felt that I really needed to be part of it. So when I got out of high school, and just before I got out, I made a decision to, even though I had a full 4-year scholarship for college, I decided that I would go in the Marine Corps and go through the war first, and then I'd take my college skip, the 4 years that I had, that the coach got me for being what he considered a track star.
Well, it sounds like it to me. And that's I know who that coach is. It's funny, the years I was playing for Las Banas High, and people would see my last name and they thought I was related to Carlisle Lofton, the football and track coach. The stadium's named after him there, but he was your coach who got you a scholarship. And you said you weren't drafted or anything. You decided to give up that scholarship to go into the Marine Corps?
Yes, not give it up, but postpone it.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't have to do that.
No, I didn't have to. No, I didn't have to. But I just felt the need to be part of the overall picture. And I had no buddies in the Marines at that time, but it was just something that somehow or another just took my mind that I'd like to be part of it. And that's really how I got going into the Marine Corps. And then I decided to put my schooling, my four-year scholarship, just put it away until I got out. And unfortunately, when I got out, I wasn't the athlete that I was when I went into Marines. So that didn't quite work.
Funny how that works out. And our plans never quite work out the way we envision them. I want to ask you, you know, it seems to me that having a brother so close in age to you certainly helped you when you were living in an orphanage as a child. What about at that time in your life when you made that decision to go into the Marine Corps? What was your brother doing, and what did he think about your idea?
My brother's a superstar, and he taught school for 32 years in Kingsburg. I loved him dearly, and everybody in Kingsburg almost felt the same way. He just was a super. And as far as the Marine Corps part was concerned, we never discussed that necessarily, because he knew that if this is what I wanted, this is what I wanted, and he wasn't going to change it.
Did he end up in the service too?
No, he wanted to desperately. He tried four different times to get into the service, but he had flat feet, and they just turned him down every time. And he tried really, really hard to the point that it really would not work for the government as far as his physicalness is concerned. So he had to back off, but he tried four different times to get that done, to get into the service. He tried the Army, the Marines, and the Navy, but all of them just couldn't take him physically.
And why was it that you decided the Marine Corps is the place for me? Had you seen some newsreels or read about them in the newspaper? Why did you think being a Marine was more exciting than going off to veterinary school and running track?
That's a real good question, and I wish I could answer it intelligently. But I going back all the years, I just was fascinated by the Marines. I didn't have any close friends that were Marines, but I guess advertising or whatever you want to call it, and I just felt that if I could be a Marine, I could be a real top man, and I think that was my goal.
Was it what you thought it was going to be, or were there some surprises once you actually got there?
Well, I got hit so bad and so soon, but I was glorified by it, and I still am involved in the Marines as far as the Marine Corps League and all these things, and I'm very proud that I was.
And it wasn't long. You go in 43. Wasn't long till you saw some action. What was your first taste of action with the Marines?
That was Saipan. And time-wise, I went in the Marines when I wasn't quite 18. And so I was in young. I was young compared to most of them in that time. So I was in four major battles, and the Marshall Islands was not that tough. But over the course of action, I was honestly killed a good 300 more as far as our enemies concerned, that kept the Japanese. And I was in it real heavy, and I just felt the need to be really good. And the thing that, in my case, I'm not saying this is a good thing, but for me it was a good thing that when I shot somebody, I was shooting a rabbit. I wasn't shooting a people, and so it didn't bother me mentally because I was in, say, four major battles that were high up on the front lines, but it didn't. Some friends of mine later on, they're really, unfortunately, they just had to mentally just exploded, and still after all these years they still have a problem with that. In my case, I didn't.
Just in terms of coming to grips with having to kill other human beings. So in your mind, you made that distinction early. You just changed the way that you thought about it, huh?
That's exactly correct. Yeah, I didn't. I was concerned. I was shooting a rabbit, and it wasn't a human thing.
The other part of that equation, though, is even if you picture them as rabbits in your brain, they still shoot back at you. And you got hit there for the first time on Saipan?
I got hit the first time Saipan. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. What do you remember about that incident, where you were, what was going on, and how you got hit?
It wasn't anything that I felt. Again, mentally, I was really strong in that time. It didn't at the time. I can't remember really what, but it didn't affect me very much. And I kept on fighting, and I was bleeding pretty bad on my arms and so forth, but shoulders. But it didn't really affect me as far as. In fact, I refused to go to the hospital. I'd rather go back to my outfit, and that's what I did. I still wanted to be involved.
As just a young man and you know, a teenager when you signed up, I imagine you never experienced anything like battle. What was the most difficult thing to get used to? I mean, and how did you make it from one day to the other?
It was actually, as far as I was concerned, I got so involved in the Marines. In the way of even when I went in, I was full strong, wanting to be a Marine, wanting to be a top man, and I didn't really have a feeling of having. I just felt strong, even though I got hit pretty bad on the second battle. It didn't change my attitude at all. I just wanted to keep on moving.
Were there some older Marines? I mean, I've read stories, and certainly you had heard about some of the earlier battles with great casualties among the American forces. I've read a lot about the Marines who were in before World War II started, the old breed in the 1st Marine Division. Did you have some older Marines who kind of took you under their wing and at least gave you some kind of warm-up or inkling of what it might be like?
No, I really didn't. I wish I had of, but I didn't. And I don't think at that time, thinking back, that I felt myself so strong that I just didn't have any feeling of being weak or danger, and I knew it was dangerous, but it didn't bother me. I just went, hell, I will make it, you know, and it's not a problem. And I just kept right on thinking that direction, and even when I got hit towards the the last Iwo Jima, I was literally destroyed, but I still felt strong about the Marines.
Well, we're going to talk about Iwo Jima and the rest of Max Roof's time in the Marine Corps in World War II. Right now, we'll take a break, come back with more of his story. Max Roof, 86 years old of Fresno, our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today is a Semper Fi guy, a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, Max Roof, 86 years old, lives in Fresno, California now. Spent much of his life in my hometown of Los Banos, which I drove through today on the way to the Bulldog game coming up tonight, Fresno State against San Jose State. That'll kick off at 5. We have the rest of this hour to talk about World War II, and more specifically, this Marine's experiences in the Pacific. So we talked a little bit about Saipan. You were wounded on the arm there, but didn't want to be taken off the lines. When the sun went down on Saipan, I imagine you had to steal a little bit of shut-eye at some point, but how do you sleep in a war zone? Did you ever find a way to actually put your mind at ease and close your eyes and sleep without fear of being attacked?
Yes. Actually, I was so exhausted already from crawling from different place to different place that it was great to be able to lay down and I closed my eyes and how long I'm not sure. I mean, how many? If it was 2 hours or 3 hours, or it gave me enough energy to keep on moving.
Now, how did you operate as far as how many guys you would try to advance with or move forward with? What? Give me a taste for the size of the group that you were with and what kinds of things you did to accomplish the ultimate goal of securing that island.
40 or 50. And they were, but we were all pretty much frontline positions in this type of thing. And this one incident that was kind of interesting, I was brought back to the big guns, 155s and so forth, and that picture though indicates that. And then they needed somebody to come up to knock out this particular spot that was being hit by all of the troops down below, and need somebody to be able to do that. And because I also was involved in the guns, and also I had other experience in the front lines for a long time too. I say for a long time.
It's all relative, right? And you mentioned a picture. I will post that picture at kmjnow.com. Go to the Hometown Heroes portion of our website. You'll see a picture of Max holding up a small Japanese flag, and on his ears you'll see those protective earphones, a telltale sign that he was near those big guns that could make a whole lot of noise. So there was a Japanese gun that was hurting your position, and you guys had to go take it out?
Yeah, fact is, so we had to move forward, and there were three of us that took this, including myself, and we moved this gun. It was the not the 155, but much smaller. I'm trying to think of the size right now, and I can't off the top of my noggin. But we could drive it, not drive it, but roll it. I was a gunner on this picture because I had experience from the back end there, and that was interesting because we did knock out the whole group up there that was hitting all of our people down below. And then I went back then to my gun, and then later on I went back to being in the infantry as well, as far as front line was concerned, because our captain was short of people and needed so they knew who I was, and so they took me, and I didn't mind going either.
I know you learn to improvise in a hurry in a situation like that. You know, you talk about being on the front lines and your captain being short men, and that's what I was going to ask you about. It's pretty hard to escape the casualties. And just to put it in perspective for our listeners, in this Battle of Saipan, a three-week battle from the middle of June to early July of 1944, nearly 3,000 Americans were killed, more than 10,000 wounded. How did it affect you to see guys that you knew, guys that you had trained with, guys that you had maybe bunked with, lying there dead on the island? What was that like, and how did you deal with it?
I dealt with it pretty simple. It was, again, I passed over them, and it didn't really affect me mentally. I was mad. I was, you know, really, 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 really mad, and trying to get the people who did it already to us. But thinking back just for a second, it didn't change my attitude. Except I was a Marine, and I wanted to do what I was supposed to be doing, and that was killing the people that were killing us. And that's kind of why I think and the people and buddies of mine that were laying down there, and I was crawling back over them and so forth, sure, it affected me, but it didn't affect me on a permanent basis.
Did it ever make you stop and think, that might be me tomorrow or in 10 minutes, that could happen to you?
Sure, you bet. Yeah, and constantly. And you kept looking backwards, but didn't change my thoughts or anything. I just, and again, for some reason or other, I didn't worry a lot about being killed. I just knew I wasn't going to be, and they weren't going to get me.
Where do you think that came from? Is that something from your childhood or growing up, that mentality that it wasn't going to happen to you, that you were going to make it through?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. Part of it, I think, really was the training I got in the Marines before the war. I think I had a great training in that phase of it, and mentally and physically I was really strong and very, very healthy because of my track records and so forth in school. So I just didn't, it didn't affect me mentally, but I was just hard to I knew that I'd make it one way or another.
And you did. You're sitting here talking to me, so that's proof enough for me. One more question about that situation and throughout the war with the enemy you encountered. I don't know how much they told you about your enemy beforehand, but I'm sure it probably didn't take you long to realize that they were pretty determined and they weren't going to surrender, right? I mean, how soon did you realize that those Japanese soldiers were fighting to the death and did not want to be taken alive?
Well, that was automatic. We were told that, showed that, and it was just either do or die as far as they were concerned. And so we had to kill them to make sure that we didn't get killed by them. So it didn't affect me, except I knew that I had to do it completely and not just wound somebody or pass them up. It had to be done.
And what kind of weapons were you equipped with in your position? You had a rifle, grenades, anything else?
M1s, which is a rifle. And I was on some of the bigger tanks too, but basically, the M1s what I I carried and used on the front lines, and I didn't have anything fancy. It was like everybody else had, you know. Like I had a sword with me, so I could do anything I had to with that. But only used it 3 times to get one of the fellows that was coming at me, and I shot and couldn't. I missed him. Got the other. He came right at me, and I was able to get down and kill him with my. But that was rare. Other than that, it was just go all the way.
Well, and you would go from Saipan to Tinian, and those islands are often mentioned together. The strategic of importance, of course, was bringing American bombers in range of Japan. And of course, the Enola Gay famously took off from Tinian. Did you guys have any clue what you were there for and why it was so important to take these little slabs of land in the middle of the ocean?
No, we didn't. Wasn't even thinking about it. It seemed like a business. As I recall from my own personal feelings, is we were there to fight and wasn't thinking about that. It was different than that, different than that, different. It wasn't even brought out to us. It was, this is the one and that's it. We focused right on that one. And then when that was done, then we discussed other ones, and we went to that one. But it didn't give me a feeling of something that I got to do next and next.
Did you ever get a sense of relief? The battle's over. We can go back on a ship, or we can stay here for a couple nights and not have to worry about fighting the next day? Or was that something you never really experienced?
No, well, when I got might say buried in a bag off of Iwo Jima, I was just totaled. I knew then that I'd be done. There's no way but mentally, I was hurt some too because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But it didn't give me a feeling of well, thank God I'm this way now because I don't have to fight anymore. It didn't seem to get in my mind.
Well, I want to talk about Iwo Jima. I know I said that once before, but we're going to take another commercial break. And when we come back, we'll talk about that little sulfur island, Iwo Jima, in the Pacific. You've probably heard about it. You've seen the famous photo atop Mount Suribachi. But how much do you know about what actually happened there? Maybe Max Roof can fill in some of those blanks for us when we come back. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue with World War II Marine Corps veteran Max Roof, 86 years old, lives in Fresno now. When World War II broke out, he was in Los Banos, California. He'd end up there after the war, started several corporations, and has a big family, has quite the legacy. But a lot of that would have never materialized if things had gone a little differently on a little island in the Pacific called Iwo Jima. I got to ask you, Max, as you were on a ship headed to an island that you'd never seen before, probably never heard before, what were your expectations of this place called Iwo Jima? I've heard some stories that Marines were told this is going to be a fast battle. It'll be over in a few days. Is that something you recall?
Not in a few days. I got the impression from what people were telling me, or the officers and so forth, that it was going to be a tough battle. But we've already been through tough battles, so don't you guys wet it. Don't worry about it because we'll get through it. And that's kind of, I took that as a reasonable thought. in my mind that it was going to be, it ended up being a lot tougher than we thought it was going to be, or was thinking it was going to be.
Well, and you'd already made a couple landings, so maybe it was nothing that new trying to land on Iwo Jima. Although I've heard that the surf there gave the LCVPs quite a job trying to land troops successfully on that ground up volcanic rock.
Yes, that was interesting on that part of it. That I could go on for a lot more stories in different ways, but that was tough. And we had fellows waving, said, "Come on in, come on in, come on in," you know, because they were starting to shell, the bombs were coming in now, and wasn't the last one. I was about in the middle of the group that,
and the Japanese, of course, from atop Mount Suribachi, had all that artillery shooting down at you, trying to get on the beach.
Exactly, and we needed to get off the beach, and this one time that I remember is that I got off the beach and. Boy, they were just, bombs were going like mad, shells were, and so forth. And I spotted this little hole over here, kind of a cave-like. I said, "Let me get in that and get out of this mess for a minute, you know." And so I got in there, and it was all dark, and I couldn't see. But finally, I could see what was in there was shells and bombs and so forth to be picked up somewhere along the way by the Japanese themselves. It was their own weapons. And so I said, "I'm going to get out of here," because they were showing, they were just a mess. So I got out of that deal, and I found out later that it hit and really exploded. but I wasn't there.
Thankfully, good thing you got out when you did. And for people who aren't familiar, there were caves like that and a network of tunnels all over that island where the Japanese had guns, and you guys didn't know about much of that.
That is exactly correct, and we didn't. And unfortunately, most of our, about the 30 or 40 people that I was involved with in it and out of it, so to speak, about half of them made it. I was one of them that did make it, mostly. I was...
Well, that's debatable. We have to hear that story. From the time that you hit the beach to the time that you were wounded on Iwo Jima, how much time passed there? How early on in the battle were you hit? And I ask that because, I mean, this was not an overnight success. This was a long, drawn-out, heavy price paid for battle. 35 days it lasted. So were you at the beginning of that 35-day stretch, the end of those 5 weeks, or maybe somewhere in the middle?
It was way back into the middle almost. I wasn't hit on the beach itself. I got hit further back in when they finally got a whole bunch of Japanese armor and actually men got came through and was hitting a bunch of us that got hit bad, and they did it, and that was what they were there for. But I was able to at least get back alive, and I came back in a. They didn't think I was even alive. They thought I was.
Well, I want to ask you more about that and get all the details. But between the time that you got there and the time you were wounded, there was a lot happening on this island. And of course, the most famous thing that happened on that island is something that you were there for. The flag went up. Well, it went up twice. Two different flags went up atop Mount Suribachi.
You're right.
What do you remember seeing and hearing, and what did it mean to you?
Well, I was in front. I never forget it. That one time, I was in front, and when there was a lot of explosion going on, and I was kind of digging in along with about 10 other guys that were trying to get underneath it a little bit. So I did look back this one time, and seen that we were kind of taking it over, but I was moving forward to fight the Japanese out there that were still there. But it was, in a sense, kind of exciting to be there and to see that we're taking things over, at least physically, and I hope mentally as well.
But there's no time to cheer when somebody's shooting at you.
No, it wasn't. It was either die or not die. You had no choice. And But that was okay. We made it out, and several thousand, I said earlier, that was killed in Evo, and I wasn't one of them. But I had eventually four back operations, hip replacement, and a lot of internal injuries and so forth. But I came out fairly good.
Well, from what I hear, you came out awfully strong. Your wife is vouching for that.
My wife is the one that did it all. She is so powerful.
I want to hear the rest of this story, but I do want to ask you one more thing about Mount Suribachi and that indelible image, that Rosenthal photo of the group hoisting that flag. That photo is on the back of your business card. When you look at that photo now, when you look at the Marine Corps statue at Arlington National Cemetery there that honors those men and everyone who fought there, what do you think of when you see that image?
One thing, I feel proud. I really do. And I'm so proud that I went into the Marines. Even though I got banged up pretty bad, to me, I was proud, and I still am.
And I don't blame you. And of course, if anyone's been to that beautiful statue near Washington, D.C., that brings that photograph to life in a 3D sense, they've seen the quote on the side from Admiral Nimitz that says, "Among the Marines in the Pacific, uncommon valor was a common virtue." Is that something that means something to you? Do you believe that to be true? Is that what you saw in the guys that you served with?
I have to say yes. In the Marines, good people now that I love dearly, who's Lieutenant Colonel and John Lockie, for example, and just guys that are just so super in every way and so thoughtful and so helpful in watching him and handle other Marines that need help in the way of mentally particularly. So I just am thrilled that I'm part of that. I'm way under their caliber, I'm telling you, but they really make me proud.
Are you saying once a Marine, always a Marine? Is that what I hear?
That's what you heard, sir. That's exactly correct.
Well, let's talk about this injury, because I know we've alluded to it a few times, but if you can, share with our listeners the details of what happened to you, what you were doing, where you got hit, what it felt like. Walk me through that, if you can. What were you doing at that time?
I was fighting with a rifle. Guys coming in like mad, Marines and fighting Marines, I should say, but guys that were the Japanese, but also more Marines were coming in trying to protect. Everybody was there too. And when I got hit, the first time I got hit, or on Net Island, I almost mentally lost it. I just knew that I was hurt bad, but I kept kind of fighting, but not really. I kind of figured out what do I do next? Where do I go? And how do I get out of here? But I didn't until they picked me up in a blanket and got me out.
So it was shrapnel from a landmine and fragments of a hand grenade that got you at the same time?
It was mostly hand grenades that got hit me, that got me badly fouled up.
Where did it get you?
Pretty much all over, in my body and so forth. But again, I got out, you know, I went immediately to the hospital, and then to the ship out to the hospital. Then immediately flew me on to Guam. And I was in Guam Hospital for several months, and before I got back to Hawaii, and then they shipped me on then to San Francisco, and then home.
Well, I'm sorry for all these questions about the same thing, but when you say that it took you several months to recover, I think we can all tell these were pretty serious injuries. So I tell you what, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take our final commercial break here on Hometown Heroes, and then when we come back, I'm going to do my best to ask Max all the questions that will give us a better picture of how horrific his ordeal was, what kinds of things he experienced, had to endure to be here talking to us today, to be the father of six, grandfather of 16, and great-grandfather to two. That's 24 lives that never would have existed if he didn't make it back from the Pacific. So we'll get the rest of that story when Hometown Heroes continues here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Well, all the U.S. Marine Corps veterans out there recognize that tune. It's a Semper Fi guy today, Max Roof, 86 years old, of Fresno, California. When we left off, I promised that I would be asking more questions about that situation on Iwo Jima more than 3 weeks into the battle when he was wounded, had to be carried off in a body bag. But I want some more details, and I think you do too, so let's pick up there.
So a grenade goes off, and the shrapnel goes everywhere, and this hit your front, not your back? I mean, did you get it in the face, the shoulders? Where did it all go?
I can't answer that intelligently. I was bleeding all over, but I didn't get any scars, you know, as bad as you have. No, I'm just teasing. I am teasing.
I haven't looked in a mirror today.
No, I really just was... I can't answer that really intelligently anymore. I'm just in regard to where I got hit on the back very seriously, and that's where I had four back operations.
I know that when there's an explosion, when there's shrapnel, sometimes you can be blinded temporarily.
That was exactly correct. I did go blind. Matter of fact, the operator on my eyes when they flew me to Guam, and I was couldn't see for about 2 weeks, and then they operated on three different times, the doctor told me later, and so eyes was a bad thing in my face and so forth, but you wouldn't take anything very large to knock your eye out, you know.
So this was a pretty big deal. I mean, you were hit pretty hard. Did you lose consciousness? Were you aware of what was going on, or were you completely out of it?
I would have to say I was aware of it. I wasn't completely out of it. I was hurting pretty bad. I wasn't crying like some of them were, and I wasn't. Didn't mean that's bad. I just wasn't. I was just hurting and. But I made it through.
And you couldn't evacuate yourself. You couldn't move yourself out of there. You had to wait for a corpsman to come help you?
No, I had to wait for almost an hour for some, that they were picking other people up as well. And I was in the group where a lot of them were dead completely in the same area. And the two guys would pick us up, take us on over to the next little spot, and then somebody else would take over, and then they would come back and try to get somebody else, and did get somebody else.
Yeah, because, I mean, the battle's still raging on. It's not like they say, time out, we need to get some guys out of here. Yeah. You have to wait for the guys that are actually walking to get you out. That seems like a very helpless situation to me. When you know you're hurt, you know you're bleeding, you can't move yourself, you're waiting for an hour. What kept you focused on surviving in that hour? That's probably one of the longest hours of your life, I would imagine.
It was pretty severe. I'll have to admit that I could handle it and did handle it without any. It wasn't anybody's fault. It wasn't our fault that in the way of I couldn't. They couldn't get to me, you know. But it was hurting so bad that I'm not even sure I was going to make it, frankly.
That was going to be my question. Did you think that you were going to die? And when that thought comes in your head, it seems like a lot of times it's downhill from there. That's not a thought that you want to go through your head. But you wondered if you'd make it.
Yeah, actually, that's correct. I didn't think I would, and I was 18 years old, or 19 at this point. So I haven't lived very long yet. But I didn't feel that. I just knew that I'd make it somehow or another. But if I didn't, I didn't. And that was kind of my philosophy a little bit too, even back then.
When you're in a situation like that, with so many casualties as there were on that island in particular. Sometimes stretchers can be in high demand, and they're not always there when you need them. So they didn't have a stretcher to carry you out, and they actually put you in a body bag?
A body bag's what it was. There were too many guys having need to help, you know. So I don't even see a stretcher now. And looking back, all I seen was body bags, guys picking up in bag bags. There'd be two guys, one in front, one back, and they'd get us in and go.
you're not completely there in a situation like that when you're so severely wounded. But if you are starting to think you're not going to make it, then putting you in a body bag doesn't encourage you very much, I wouldn't imagine.
Didn't make it. I didn't even think about it.
You just wanted to get out of there.
Yeah, that's right. No, it didn't even dawn on me that if I should be on something else. Where's my stretcher? Where's my stretcher? It didn't even occur to me.
It makes a good story to tell these days, huh? When you tell your grandkids you got carried off of Iwo Jima in a body bag.
I don't say that to anybody, pretty much.
Well, I'm glad you fessed up to us. So they took you to Guam, and you said months of recovery. It seems like that would be a challenging time to you, too. What do you remember about that time period and the challenges that you faced just to be able to function again?
Yeah, that was tough. I have to admit that because I really was hurting all over, not just my eyes, but my whole body. For a long, long time, I couldn't walk, and it was miserable, I got to say that. And then when I couldn't talk either, I'm not talking very good now, I admit that. but then I was really, I stuttered just 100% almost. You couldn't even understand me. And why I could go out and get a job and start my own business, to talk to people on how to do this, I mean, talk about even whitewashing, you know, because I got it done. And I got the jobs that I wanted. The timing was right. It wasn't that I was that good, but it was just timing was good, and they needed the job done, and nobody else was doing it, so okay, give them a try, you know.
I know it's been a long time since then, but when you think back of that time after you were injured, the long recovery, and then trying to get yourself back into life, was there one thing that really motivated you or picked you up or kept you moving forward to experience the life that you've been able to lead for the last 65 years?
It sure was. One thing, and this sounds kind of goofy, but I did not want to be poor. That was the big thing. As I mentioned to you, my folks were just lovely, 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 but because they lost all their money in back in the 30s in the Depression, and then they never recovered, really. And so I never experienced except I just didn't want to be just poor. I just had to make that was the main thing that made me go forward and I have to say be successful, and we were. And with six children and a beautiful wife, I was successful all over. And
well, and I want to talk to you about that. We've got a few minutes left in the program here, and it's clear, I think, to anyone listening that you've beaten a lot of odds. I mean, here you are, orphaned as a child, nearly killed on Iwo Jima, and you're here talking to me today. But maybe the most impressive thing you can claim was landing your bride, because that was a pretty good challenge, too. I understand that it started with a bet that you couldn't get this girl to go on a date with you. Tell me that story, because you're back from the war. You're back in Las Banas, and you see this pretty young thing?
Yes, actually, and she is still young and still beautiful, and yes, back there's one of my vice presidents, Lloyd Cotta, Las Banas man also, and worked for me for a lot of years, and a top man. And also Ed Lewis was passed away here a few years ago now, but a top serviceman as well. Anyway, both of them were at this meeting I was at with Westinghouse, and they both said, well, Max, I bet you can't date her.
That's what we guys do, don't we? When we got nothing better to do, we just pick on each other when it comes to women.
Yeah. I said, well, I could if I wanted to, you know. And so I got to meet her a little bit, and I have to admit, I could say that they were right. She's so classy and so much fun that you could tell that. And I haven't even held her hands yet. I decided to ask her for a date, and she was very nice and said that, well, a good friend of hers just had a miscarriage, and she wanted to be with her, and she promised to be into it. So that was one of them. The next one was the same thing. So finally, on the third one, I said, would you have the nerve to turn me down four times for a date? She says, no, sir, I wouldn't.
Was that Marine Corps persistence there? What was that?
I must have learned that in the Marines. That's right. But it was just a few months when it seemed like we got married, and
3 months, yeah. So she turned you down three times. You finally got her to go with you, and 3 months later, you married her. And
yes. so much fun. We just literally love it at first sight for me. And it was in every way. I would never change it. If I could, and I wouldn't. I wouldn't want to. But it was beautiful all the way through. And with six children. And then when I asked her, you know, how many children would you like to have before we got married? Now she's 21 years old. She says, I would like to have six. And I said, I can handle that. I said, well, that's going to be fun. But it went on and on, and we just had a great time and a great life.
And you're still going and still married after all these years, six children, 16 grandchildren, two great-grandchildren. None of them would have been here if that body bag was for a different reason on Iwo Jima. We're thankful for that. And she's still the best-looking usher at Bulldog Stadium, right?
Well, no question about it. There's just absolutely, that should you be asking that? You should look, damn it. And
well, when you think back on it all, Max, with everything you've been through in your life, all the different challenges that you faced, when you look back, what are you most thankful for? And how do you think this has happened to you? Why you? Why has your life been so special?
I don't know. And I thank God, generally at least once a week, sometimes often than that, for what he's given me, because there's no other way I could have got it without. And then this young lady here that I married, and that was salesmanship on my part, but it worked out to where she's perfect. She absolutely was, as a wife, as a friend, and I might say also as a lover, and everything. She's just great, and still is. And I just am so thankful that I've gone this far, and I could die tomorrow and smile. Literally could smile, because I've done it all. And that's how I feel inside. So I have no complaints. I really do not have any complaints.
Well, I don't blame you. That's pretty special. I think a lot of our listeners are probably hearing all this saying, well, I want to see what these people look like. So I'll post a picture of you on our website at kmjnow.com, and then everyone can see for themselves. And just in closing, Max, with regard to the Marine Corps and the guys that you served with, and we've said all the catchphrases, once a Marine, always a Marine, and Semper Fi. I haven't gotten a hoo-wow out of you, but you can share one if you want.
You got that. You know that. And I could go on for an hour and a half, and you won't give me that much time to talk about the buddies and the Marines. And the ones now that I see in the Marine Corps League, and ones that have done it all themselves, they're way ahead of me, I think, in many ways. But they're so neat. And I'm so thankful that I'm able to be just a small part of that group.
Well, I don't know if you're quite doing yourself justice there, but Max, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the courage and willingness to talk to us about it today. And God bless you and your beautiful family. That's Max Roof, 86 years old, of Fresno, California. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.